We're up to session 48, which sounds very strange to say, but I know we've had some hits and misses with schedule, but just want to remind everybody we will not be having class next week because of Thanksgiving. You know that we have a Thanksgiving Eve or Thanksgiving Double Eve service at Harvest Time. So our service is at Tuesday night. We used to do a Wednesday Thanksgiving Eve service, and it just got too crazy for people with traffic and traveling. So we have a service now on Tuesday, and then there's no programs, no kids programs or anything on Wednesday nights, so everybody can just kind of nestle in and get ready to be with their families and so forth. And then, you know, we don't have anything running on Thursday and Friday either. 7 o'clock Tuesday evening. And that's always just a great service of worship and testimony. So I hope you guys can make it out. Last time we were together, we looked into Genesis 38 at the story of Judah and Tamar. And this was kind of a parenthesis in the story of Joseph. Moses wants us to see that while things were happening in Joseph's life, God didn't forget the rest of the family. Aren't you glad about that? He was continuing to work in them as well. And I'm glad that God's always working with everybody's future in mind. And fortunately, he's the only one that can do it. But fortunately, he can do it all at the same time. He can work on parallel tracks like nobody else. And it's in Genesis 38 that Judah begins to grow into a person of noble character, we said. I won't go through all that again. Just encourage you, go to the website and listen to that lesson we recorded last week. But the main thing we can take away from chapter 38 is that God was continuing to prepare Judah's heart for the leadership of the people of Israel. Judah was the first of Jacob's sons who showed brokenness, who showed some humility in his heart. And being able to recognize his own wrongdoing and being able to see how he had harmed other people, that's the key to that story. So as we move into chapter 39, we're returning to our focus on Joseph. And here we find Joseph, a slave in the house of Potiphar. So, interesting question. How accurate is this setting that we're going to read about in the next few chapters? You know, there are lots of people, right, who criticize the Bible and want to tear down the faith of Christians by saying that the historical accounts that we find there contained in the Bible are not accurate and things like that. And I think that nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I said before that although the Bible is not a science book, it certainly doesn't say anything that is scientifically incorrect. And we talked about lots of examples of that as we've gone through the class. I mean, the Bible knew, all the way back in Job, the oldest book in the Bible knew that there were currents in the ocean. And we didn't rediscover that again until the 1700s. But we knew about it in the book of Job, which is the oldest book in the Bible. And the same way, you know, the Bible's not a history book, but it's always historically accurate. You know, obviously some books in the Bible are meant to be histories, but even when the history is secondary to some other portion or some other goal, I should say, that God has there, the Bible is always historically accurate. So Christians can have confidence in their Bible. And as we go through the story of Joseph, we want to build up your confidence in its reliability as well. We've also said from time to time that in many cases, archaeology just is simply not advanced enough to shed much light on what's in here. And critics have used these holes in our knowledge to try to say that these stories are made up. But the critics themselves are frequently found to be wrong. And so anybody who makes a statement like that is making it at their own peril. I think I've given you this example before that, you know, we did not even have any physical evidence for the existence of a man named Pontius Pilate until 1966. And we had writings that talked about him, but you know, they had never found anything, any stone, any carving, any statue, nothing that said this man's name on it until only 50 years ago. Now there's someone whose name features very prominently, right, in the gospel stories. People go to churches and they say his name every week, right? He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and he's a Roman official, and yet we never had anything tangible referring to this man until only 50 years ago. Now, when we're talking about Genesis and we're talking about Joseph's life, right, the difficulties are much greater, of course, than they would be with the New Testament, because we're talking about customs and places and names and things from maybe 3,700 years ago. So this is far back. This is even before I graduated high school, and it's a long time ago. And not only that, but Moses didn't even write the story of Joseph until centuries after these events took place. So, but nevertheless, from what we do know about Egyptian history, what we have in the story of Joseph makes sense. It's a very good reflection of what we know about Egyptian life in this period. So even if we don't have direct evidence of Joseph, although some people think we do, and we'll talk about that, it rings true to what we know about Egypt. The details in Joseph's life give us great clues so that we can figure out what period of history are we talking about here. And those clues tell us that this is a story that sounds authentic. You know, when somebody's telling you a story and you just, that just doesn't sound like that could possibly have happened. When we tell the Joseph story, we are getting a story that has the ring of truth. It sounds authentic to what we know about Egypt. It sounds right. And we'll see some examples of that as we go along. Now, I've given you a map, so we can talk just for a minute about Egypt. You know how I like to give you these little tidbits, whether we're talking about Edomites or any other ites, right? But I've given you a map there of Egypt on the back so we can get a little bit of background. The central feature in Egypt, something that has always determined its destiny, of course, is the Nile River. In prehistoric times, Egypt was, people think, was a lot more green. But certainly by this time, by the time of the patriarchs, the Nile River was the main source of water for agriculture and everything else. So at a certain time of the year or certain points within the year, the Nile will flood it over its banks and the water will wash over its banks. And then that lets people use it for farming. And nearly all the population in Egypt was along the banks of the Nile and in the Nile Delta, where the river meets the Mediterranean Sea up there. I think you can see that on the map. I hope you can. And that's true even today. It's a necessity because you just get not too many miles away from that river and there's just you in the sand, right? So some of the terminology of Egypt can throw us because the terminology of Egypt is a little backwards to people, right? So in Egypt, historically, you've got two main geographic sections. You have Upper Egypt and you have Lower Egypt. But what confuses people is that Upper Egypt is in the south and Lower Egypt is in the north. And that seems backward to us because of the way that we're used to looking at a map. But we call it Upper Egypt because Upper Egypt is the source of the Nile. The source of the Nile is down in the south towards Sudan and Africa. And it flows down from there towards the north, towards the Mediterranean. So it's always been referred to as Upper and Lower Egypt for thousands of years, but to us, it just looks backwards. So that's a little tricky thing for you. The Egyptian civilization was very ancient, and Egyptians thought of themselves as the two lands, meaning the Upper and Lower Egypt. The king, in the very ancient times, was called the Lord of the Two Lands. So when we go back really far, the historians would say to about 3000 BC. So obviously, things are very fuzzy at that point, right? They even argue, who was the first king and what was his name? And, well, we don't think that was his name. We think that was a mythological person. You know, when you're talking about 5,000 years ago, it's hard to know anything. But sometime around there, they believe that a king united those two lands for the first time. And you might have seen this in the Bible movies if you're paying attention. Pharaoh always has a very particular crown. So there were two crowns. The crown of the south was white, and the crown of the north was red. And so when these two lands joined together, the Pharaoh, to emphasize that he ruled over all the kingdoms of Egypt, they wore this combined crown that had the red and the white together. So next time you watch a Bible movie and you notice that, you'll thank me. And you could just be great. You know, you can impress everybody as you're on Netflix watching this thing. You see that dual crown that the Pharaoh has, right? And you can explain it to everybody and you'll think of me. So, all right. Well, the Egyptians would push back in an effort to expand their territory. They would fight in a few different directions. They were always waging war in the south against black African tribes. They would fight in the west against tribes that were what we would call Libya along the coast. And they would fight in the east against the Canaanite tribes. Now, you know, these nations are all existing together for many, many centuries. And there are cycles in these things where, kind of like if you know history of Europe, you know that Europe in Europe you have countries like England and France, let's say, have been at each other's throats on and off for hundreds of years, right? So it was the same thing in this corner of the world, except for much longer. So at different times in their history, Egypt would be strong, and then they would become rivals to the nations in the east, like the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Persians. At other times, Egypt would be weak, and then those empires would come down and rule over Egypt or have more influence over Egypt. So who's in the middle, of course, is who the Bible is most about, is the people of Israel. So the land of Israel occupies this very unfortunate position. God says it's the middle of the earth, the middle of the land of the earth. It's a bridge between Africa and Asia. So the people of Canaan, or later the people of Israel, were always coming under the dominion of Egypt or the dominion of the various countries up here, depending on who was stronger at the time. And even if Israel or Judah was trying to stay out of it, their country was still being used as a battleground and as a highway for the people who wanted to go from one side to attack the other side. So talk about always getting caught, you know, in the middle. So that was their unfortunate position. Very interesting, in Hebrew, the word for Egypt is in the Bible was Mitzrayim. And that's a word which can have a few different meanings, but it can mean the two fortresses. So going all the way back to the beginning, this could be a reference to the fact that these two lands united to make one Egyptian people. Other languages in the region called Egypt by a very similar name, and they still do. So even today, Egypt is called Mitzrayim in Hebrew, and in Arabic they call it Mitzer. Where does the word Egypt come from? So if that's what the name of Egypt is, where do we get a weird name like Egypt? Well, it comes from the Greeks, and it has to do with the Aegean Sea. They believe that it means, in Greek, it's the land to the south of the Aegean Sea, which makes sense. So if you were a Greek person on the other side of the Mediterranean, what is Egypt to you? It's the southern land. So basically, that's what Egypt means. As far as their government, I think most of us know that the kings of Egypt were called pharaohs, and we're going to see this word in the story of Joseph. It's an interesting word. It means great house. So if you go back far enough in history, the pharaoh was not talking about the man. The pharaoh was talking about the place he lived in. He's the man of the great house. So over time, the word went from talking about the palace to talking about the guy who's in charge of the palace. It was not originally a title like Pharaoh so-and-so and Pharaoh this guy, but by the time of Moses, it was a title. Where do we find Joseph in history? Egypt has had a very long history. So if you can kind of trace your history back to the time of the flood, you know, there's a traditional Bible chronology which may or may not be accurate, but, you know, the historians believe that they can trace Egyptian history back pretty good to about, you know, 2800 or 3000 BC. So the Egyptians and the Chinese are probably the two oldest civilizations that are still around unbroken. And the historians divide the history of Egypt into different dynasties of kings and then even longer periods called kingdoms. And we have enough knowledge, historians have enough knowledge of what the customs were like and the culture was like in these different kingdoms to be able to place a person like Joseph in history. And they do this by, you know, analyzing the words, the social customs, the level of technology, and all these different things, which we can see in the text if we know what we're looking for. And then we compare the situation, the social situation, and all these things in Joseph's time to what the historians know. And because of that, the historians would tell us that Joseph lived in the time frame that we call the Middle Kingdom, which went from about 2000 BC to 1600 BC, give or take. Now that kind of matches up with what we know about the history of Israel, because if Joseph was there about 1700, 1750 BC, and we know that the Israelites were there as slaves, right, for 400 years, that takes us very well to the time that the people come out under Moses and Joshua. So if we want to put a date on Joseph, my best guess would be that we're talking about 1700 BC or so. So long time ago. All right. Well, that's enough of that. Hopefully your eyes are not glazing over, but I always like to take a look and see what country we're in and how we're doing there. All right. Let's jump into this chapter 39 and see how Joseph's been making out. Verse 1 says, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man." Now, by the way, when you see that Lord there in some versions in capital letters, it means the divine name of God. So, in other words, Moses wrote there Yahweh, God's divine personal covenant name. So this is not El, this is not Elohim, it's Yahweh when you see that. "So the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate." All right, so you remember that Joseph's brothers had sold him to some Amalekites or Ishmaelites, and now he's been sold to this high-ranking governmental official. What do we know about Mr. Potiphar? Well, probably nothing. But his name, as far as we know, is a very common name of the type that would have been quite prevalent in Egypt during this time. So whoever is writing this, is what I'm getting at, whoever writes this centuries later knows that. So if you and I were sitting around tables like this and say, let's make up a fictitious story about a guy who lived in Egypt hundreds of years ago, could you do it and come up with names that were real Egyptian names? Which, again, remember, the identity of these names and their meaning would not be discovered again by Westerners until the 1800s. See what I'm getting at? So to fake this, you would have to have been there in that setting to be able to come up with names and things like that. So what do we know about Potiphar, though, the man? Well, we don't know anything about him. He is head of the palace bodyguard, which that word means he could also be, and this is an interesting title. I hope none of you ever meets anybody with this title, but his name could also mean that he was the chief killer, the chief executioner, it can mean. So that's all we know about him. So this is a very highly placed person, a person who knows the Pharaoh, Pharaoh trusts him implicitly. He works under the Pharaoh. He's probably in charge of all of Pharaoh's bodyguards. Right away in verse 2, you see that God is with Joseph. Now, this is a really interesting contrast. When we saw the story of Judah last week, we know that God was working in Judah's life through this hidden providence, right? He was working in secret in Judah's heart. But in Joseph's life, God is working in a very open and manifest way, a very obvious way. God put an anointing for success on him. And we're sure that this, right, would have included a great wisdom in administration, as well as a supernatural touch on his life, which gave him prosperity coming in everything that he did. It says that Potiphar was blessed because of Joseph, both in the house and in the field. Now, this would have been their primary means of wealth in this society. We know that because this is too early in history for people to just get paid in coin money, right? There were no coins yet. I know that's weird because that's all we know is money, right? In that sense. If Tony does work for me in my house, I'm not going to hand him a weight of a chunk of silver that we're going to weigh on a scale. But that's how it was done there. Coins would not be invented until about 900 BC. So the fact that Potiphar has lands means he's wealthy, because if Pharaoh's going to pay you, that's how he's going to pay you. I'm making you my great servant. Behold, I give you lands in this province and that prop, right? You tracking with me this? So that's how it would have worked. And so his land was the source of his wealth. Joseph apparently was put over everything, and that made him a kind of a chief steward of the estate. And we know exactly what this position was called in the Egyptian language. The historians know exactly what the duties were of a person like this. Joseph would have been the supervisor of all the personnel, the supervisor of all the slaves. He would also have been a scribe. In the Egyptian society, not everybody wrote. Even the people of importance did not necessarily know how to write. Joseph must have been a very bright guy, because to be in that position, he would have had to be the scribe, to do correspondence, take notes, and also be the accountant for this big estate and manage payments of things, manage business, inventories, and all that kind of thing. So he must have been talented enough to pick up the writing and so forth of the Egyptians, which is, if you've ever looked at that, is not an easy thing to do. All of those symbols are sounds. It's not something I think that you and I could pick up overnight, right? So it's not just like learning a new alphabet. It's a lot more complicated than that. But the blessing on Joseph in doing this role was so obvious that Potiphar could see that it was supernatural, that there was something supernatural about it, right? Moses says, and this is a great testimony, because you have to remember that these people, with their multitude of gods, they would not be kindly disposed to a person like Joseph coming in and saying, well, there's only one God who made heaven and earth, and I serve him. But it says that his master saw that Yahweh was with him in verse 3, and he saw that Yahweh made everything that he did to prosper. That's a fantastic testimony to have at work. If you can get your unbelieving boss to say, I know that your God is with you and your God blesses everything that you do, so I'm putting you in charge of everything I own. I mean, don't just read this as a religious story. Think about this in your own life. What a crazy situation this is. I didn't believe in your God and I thought you were crazy. You're a Hebrew. You're a guy from the desert. But it's obvious to me that your God gives you success in everything you touch. And so I'm putting you in charge of all my wealth. That's pretty amazing. All right. But God blessed him also so much that this guy could just check out, as we would say. He didn't even have to worry about a single thing because Joseph was in charge of it. But there was trouble in the big house. All right, in verse 6, Moses tells us, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. That's a very polite way of saying that the guy was buff and handsome, right? It's just what he says. He was handsome in form. Means he was a shapely, well-built man. That's what it says, all right? And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, Moses again is not quite as blunt with us as he was last week, but still a little blunt. She said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? One of the great anti-sin sermons of all time, right there in just a few words. So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. So, all right, once again, the Bible is not for kids, right? It's very frank in its descriptions of such events, not to try to, you know, titillate people or to be sensational, but just to be honest about this is the reality of human behavior. Joseph was apparently a very attractive man, and so the wife comes boldly to him pretty much every day, it says, and asks him to come to bed with her. Now, in these societies, adultery was a grave sin, and it was punishable by death in most places, as it would later be under the law of Moses. Now, we think that that's odd, but, you know, if you lived not too many years ago, even in this country, adultery was a crime. Actually, I think Connecticut was the last state to get rid of that. And in older times in America, and I don't mean 1700, I mean, you know, the 1900s, you could sue people for stealing your spouse's affections away from you. It was called alienation of affections. So death penalty might strike you as a little bit much, but that has been the norm in many human societies for thousands of years. And Joseph knew that holiness and justice and love for others demanded that he not do this. Now, the rabbis are funny. The rabbis say that Joseph cooled his passions by seeing his father's face before his eyes. I guess, you know, we give different advice to people, but, you know, picturing your father, I guess, would do the trick. But the story there, of course, is that he remembered Jacob's words of instruction. So that's how he was able, they said, to defeat this temptation. But if you just don't get silly with me, but see what Moses actually said in the text, Joseph was able to resist these advances because he did not allow his passions to go unchecked. First, he used godly reasoning, right? So he reminds himself and reminds Mrs. Potiphar that this is not only in adultery, but it was a sin of ingratitude. So it's interesting. He's a very caring person. His first thought was about his relationship with Potiphar. And he talks about it in terms, he kind of phrases it or frames it, I should say, in terms of gratitude, considering the position that Potiphar had given him. So he's telling her, he says, look, this would really be a very terrible and bitter betrayal of your husband on a personal level. And of course, it would be a sin against Potiphar and his wife in the sense of adultery. And then finally, he describes it as wickedness, and significantly, he calls it a sin against God. So he's got reasons. So this is good because this tells us that he has thought about this. He has trained his mind and rehearsed his thinking in all the reasons why this would be bad. And that's a good thing. That tells us that he's not impulsive. And if we all did this, we would, you know, we're very common to say, oh, I fell into a sin. But Joseph was not going to fall into this sin because he applied the brakes by using his noodle. And he reasoned in a godly way as to the various reasons why this was wrong. So that was his reasoning process. But then, you know, he's still a human being. So how did he really get victory over the temptation? Well, first, notice with me that he accurately saw the sin for what it was. He described it, right? There was he didn't sugarcoat it in any way, right? He knew it was a violation of God's law, and he held on to that fear of the Lord that the Bible says is the beginning of wisdom. So notice also that this temptation was there for him all the time. There was no way he was going to take a break and get away from this lady because he's a slave. But he was able to hold out against it because, listen, as Moses said, he did not heed her. He ignored her. He didn't listen. Moses says not even to be with her. Don't get caught. Don't put yourself in the situation where your mind may, or, you know, your emotions might get the best of you. So in other words, he did not toy around with this temptation, right? He didn't start saying, you know, if loving you is wrong, you know, I don't want to be right. He didn't allow himself to get to that point. And that's the danger point, right? In all these, so many of these situations. Why? Because people go halfway, especially in these adulterous connections. Well, you know, she was going through a hard time, so I just felt bad for her. I wanted to be a listening ear. Or, oh, he just seemed really lonely, and, you know, his wife, you know, whatever. So these are the things, you know. I know that might give you a chuckle, but believe me, as pastors, we've heard all this. So notice he didn't play that halfway game. He didn't go right up to the edge of seeing, you know, what he could do with not, you know, without plunging in with both feet. Moses said he did not listen and he would not even be with her. And if we handled all of our sin issues that way, you know, we would be a lot better off. Don't entertain that thought. Get out of the situation where you're going to be tempted in a particular environment. Just don't go there. Verse 11, I think most of us know the story, but it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So Joseph was following that good counsel of the Word of God that says to flee fornication, right? And he left not suspecting that this was going to be turned against him, of course, in such a severe way. Potiphar's wife is looking for people to support her. She's probably trying to guard her own reputation as well. And there's a little bit of this dynamic that when people are spurned, you know, there is that other story with David and his children where, you know, the hate with which, you know, she hated him ended up being greater than the love with which she loved him. You know what I'm talking about? When a person is spurned like that, all of a sudden now they can't stand the sight of the other person. So there may be a little of this going on here as well. There's this denigration of Joseph, right? Because he's a Hebrew. So she's making it a like foreigner thing in her mind, right? He's a Hebrew, not an Egyptian. And, you know, they've brought in this Hebrew. Hebrews were considered to be, basically for the Egyptian, they were considered to be unclean people because they were hairy, which Egyptians didn't like. Egyptians were always shaving. You see that later. Do you remember when they were, if you know later on the story, when they're going to finally bring Joseph into the Pharaoh? I should have said spoiler alert there, but when they bring him into the Pharaoh, what do they have to do? They shave him. So to them, like having hair was gross. And plus the Hebrews were known to take care of animals that were disgusting to the Egyptians. So she's like, he brought this nasty foreigner in here. That's really what she's saying in essence. So verse 16, she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came into me to mock me." So it happened. Notice right away, the Hebrew servant. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. So do you get what I'm saying there? It wasn't Joseph. She certainly knew his name. The guy is running the place for them. He's running the whole business enterprise, but it's like the Hebrew servant. Right. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. So this word mocking, that she says, you brought in this Hebrew, this foreigner to mock, it's more like humiliating. So there's this overtone there of, you know, that she's being degraded sexually is what she's getting at, really. Potiphar was in charge of the guards or the executioners. And so the fact, if you caught it, that Joseph was put in prison is very interesting. These guys had life and death power over their slaves, right? And the prisons in those days also were not places for punishment of crimes. The idea of incarcerating people for crimes is something that's actually relatively recent. That's an idea that's only been around for a couple of hundred years at most. You know, most punishment in older times, and certainly in these times, was bodily punishment or monetary compensation. So in the ancient world, a prison was a place for political prisoners, like you see Moses says here, or places where you could warehouse somebody temporarily until their fate was decided. So the fact that Joseph is not immediately put to death is because of God's favor. Of course, we know that. But humanly speaking, what's really going on here, I think, is that Potiphar had great affection for Joseph, and he did not want to see Joseph put to death. It's very possible that he did not believe his wife's story, probably because he knew what his wife was like. You cannot be this kind of person that is literally every day begging this good-looking guy to go to bed with you and have that not come out at some point in the person's attitude, right? We just know there's certain things, that not just things like this, but certain things that people do. If they are doing it like that every day, a habitual sin, you know it's going to spill out. So you know he knew what his wife was like, and the husband was away a lot, right? So on the other hand, here's Potiphar's dilemma. He can't very well, in his position, this is a guy who interacts with the king every day. He's in charge of the king's bodyguards. He cannot, in his position, ever take the word of a Hebrew slave over the word of his own wife, because he's got status. What's he supposed to do in that situation? So you notice, right, there is nothing like a trial. There is no questioning of Joseph or anything like that. That's not going to happen, right? What man, even if he's not in this position, he's going to believe his wife, or at least pretend to believe his wife because he thinks he has to. But look what happens in verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. So there it's Yahweh again, God's personal name. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority. You know, these Egyptians, they just did not like to work. So, you know, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. That's amazing. So this is really a very striking passage. And what's most striking about it is it's the primary character in this chapter is not Joseph. It's the Lord. He's the primary character in this story. Notice those repeated references. God was with him. God showed him mercy. God gave him favor. So the result is that Joseph ends up having the same arrangement that he had enjoyed in Potiphar's house. He has a position of authority, And his job was, again, probably something like that of a scribe. And we know from history, from Egyptian history, that in these prisons, that this was possible, that there were people there who supervised prisoners, who assigned them work, kept track of them, who ordered supplies, did accounting for these guys in terms of the supplies they needed and food. And Joseph was put over all of that. So God was training Joseph every day for a future in administration. So if we want to be cute, I suppose we could say Joseph got his bachelor's degree at home and his MBA in prison, right? But many people have pointed out that what Joseph really qualified himself to rule, how he qualified himself to rule was because first, he had mastery of himself in a situation where a lesser man would have given into that, because especially in those days, who's going to know, right? It would have been so easy for him to fall into that. But the result of Joseph's personal excellence was that, once again, his supervisor did not even need to worry about anything that's happening in the house. And again, God gave him such a supernatural anointing for success that whatever he did, God caused it to prosper. You know, we ought to all pray that for ourselves. Why don't we? Why don't we pray like that more? You know, if our heart is really to serve the Lord, why don't we specifically ask God to give us that Joseph anointing, that God will supernaturally cause whatever we're doing to prosper? And I love this. You would not have noticed this until later on in the story, but I'm going to tell you now. It's highly significant. This is the only place in the story of Joseph, all of it, from when he's a boy to the end of his life, that you will see the personal covenant name of God as Yahweh. Only in this chapter 39 do you see God referred to this way. And what does that tell us? It tells us that God is acting out of his faithful covenant love towards Joseph. He's sworn by himself as Yahweh to bless Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants. And so here in this story, only in this chapter, is he using that name, because here God wants you to see, Moses wants us to see, that God is personally intervening with blessings. He's not just acting as the creator God who just takes care of his children because he's a good God. This is more than this. You know, Joseph told Potiphar he can't sin against Elohim. You know, it's wrong for me to commit adultery because God, the creator, he's against that. You know, but Joseph was being blessed and being prospered by the covenant God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who wants to reveal himself, the God who wants to personally intervene for his covenant friends in history for their good. And so in this chapter, quite remarkably, you'll see, and only here will you see, the divine name of Yahweh used. So those things are little markers that, you know, if we pay attention to them, they give us some really nice insights. And I want to tell you that God is with you like that. God may bless other people in a general way just because he's good. You know, Jesus said that he makes his rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike. So he does that for everybody because he's a good God and a good creator. But he doesn't want to know you like that. He wants to know you in a personal way and intervene in your life in a powerful personal way, just like he did for Joseph. Why? Because you're his covenant friend. Mm-hmm. Joseph could talk to Potiphar and Potiphar's wife about Elohim, you know, but it's Yahweh. He wants to know you in a personal way and take care of you and be your covenant friend. So it's beautiful that Moses does that. And it encourages us, because God is for you that way through Jesus Christ. And God wants to set you apart and use you and bless you just like that, in a way that will astound the people that are around you, that only can talk about God like Elohim, like, oh, he's the big guy. He's the man upstairs, you know. Not so with you, because you know him and have been known by him. So next time we're together, we'll not be till after Thanksgiving, and we'll see how it went with Joseph in prison and his many travails. But any questions or comments on any of that?
Joseph was very young when he learned. He was 17 years old?
He was about 17 when he went down there into Egypt, right. And I apologize. I should have it on the tip of my tongue, and I don't. But when this is happening, he's in his early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he gets...
So he's really young to be doing so much good stuff.
Well, he is. He gets onto the throne beside Pharaoh, I think, when he's 30, right? So at this point, he's got about 6 or 7 years of suffering ahead of him. So yeah, he's about 23 or so at this time. So
I can't imagine anybody in our age now being that good.
Well, you know, that I feel like obviously we know that the Lord can, right, preserve us. We are in a society that's just as drenched in it as they were. The only difference is in that society, if you got caught, is over. So maybe they were just better at sneaking around than people are today. But it's all about, I think, in fighting temptation, we all give ourselves too much opportunity, right? We dance too close to all these lines. And Joseph didn't. I love it. So he didn't even give her heed. It's just like, keep walking. Ignore her. Don't even have the argument with her for the 20th time about why you can't. Just keep walking, right? You know, when the telephone started becoming a thing where everybody started to have one in their homes in the 19-teens, the 1920s, people started having their own telephones. Do you know that the preachers preached against it? Which... okay, on one level, silly, but the reason why preachers preached against it was because they said it will facilitate adultery. You will be able to connect with people and nobody will know about it. You'll be able to make rendezvous with people. So people actually used to preach against the telephone because it facilitated sin. Facilitates more, you know, gossip probably than adultery. But I understand what those preachers were trying to say 100 years ago, which is that, look, don't give yourself those opportunities. And if you know you have a weakness in a particular area, don't go there. I'm going back to the bar to preach to all my buddies. Right? I always quote Ben Franklin at this point. You know, Ben Franklin used to say, if your head is wax, don't walk in the sun. Right? Don't put yourself in that environment. And it's a great study to show, especially a younger person, how Joseph responded to temptation. What was his thought process? He understood all the reasons why he shouldn't. His relationship with Potiphar, the wrongness of breaking up their marriage, and the wrongness of defiling, you know, his own holiness with respect to the Lord, and also how he dealt with the temptation in the moment. Beautiful little study there that would be great for, you know, any teenager or any child to understand how to deal with the reality of temptations, which are so much worse than they were in 1979 when I was 17. It's a little different world. But, you know, if Joseph could do it in that environment, so can we, by God's grace.
I think they should bring the death penalty back for cheaters.
Just saying.
Well, listen.
We save a lot of problems.
You know, we...
people would think twice.
We view those things... I'm not going to say I would advocate for that, but we view those things as something medieval, and they were not medieval. Those things existed. Not the death penalty, but... in the state of Connecticut, it hasn't been prosecuted in many years, but until the 1980s, if you committed adultery, you could be sent to jail. And you say, well, you can't legislate morality. Well, every law legislates morality. And the reason why those things were crimes was because they knew, people understood that those things were destructive to society, which we know is obviously the case because we all are living in the wreckage that was caused by the idea of anything goes. So I'm not the oldest person in the room, But when I was a kid in the class of 40, you know, there was maybe only one kid whose parents were divorced. And everybody's like, oh, he comes from a broken home. Now you find the one kid who has two parents. And everybody's divorced. So it's way too crazy. But the traditional morality in Judeo-Christian countries was that adultery could be punishable by death, along with rape, with kidnapping, you know, and lots of other things. So people are like, well, that's a bit excessive. You know, we don't want to go there anymore. So listen, if you're a criminal, I guarantee you, if you're a criminal, this is the best time ever to be alive. I'm serious. Because there's so much mercy and so many second chances that are built into the system, which have never existed in history. You know, if you commit almost any crime except a really major crime where you're really hurting a human being, you don't even go to jail right away. First, you get a couple of shots, you get on the treatment track, right? Before you even get to that. So if you just behave for a year, it'll go away. Yeah. That's never been the case in history. So,
but years ago, when you know, you talk about rape and stuff, there was so much incest going on because of the way the tribes were set up, because of the way things were.
You mean in the Bible?
Yeah. Oh. How back then could they even determine what was actually like pedophilia, like criminal? Even if it was an age thing, the girls were so young that the men were taking, you know, as their wives or as their...
Well, it was custom. So, I mean, if the woman was old enough, right, to have children, then, you know, I mean, among Jewish people, at least at the time of Christ, the girls would probably be married at about 15. So when Gabriel, you know, when the angel Gabriel comes to Mary, she's like a 15 or 16-year-old girl, probably. That was normal. You know, there is a major world religion today that allows marriage at 9 because, well, no, that's what their founder did. You know what I'm talking about. So the marriage was made at 6 and consummated at 9. And they say it's okay because that's what he did. But that's not the custom for Jewish people. They've never had that. I mean, that would be viewed as horrible and, you know, abusive. Yeah, absolutely. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but, you know, it's still, as we've talked about here when it's come up before, you know, cousin marriage is still very normal, you know, in the Middle East. So if you go to a country like Pakistan, 40, 50, 60% of people are married to their cousin. And that's just how they do it, which nowadays is a huge problem. Because many of those countries have huge incidents of kids that have problems because of it. Maybe that was not so much of a problem 4,000 years ago, but today it's a huge problem. So, anybody else? That was quite a note to put on things. No? That's it? Okay. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night.
That's nice to you, Sunday.